Biographical Bites from Bala, Laurel Hill West Stories number 31 for mid-April 2024. Gladys Hall and Russell Ball, glamorizing early Hollywood. Welcome to the 31st episode of Biographical Bites from Bala, Laurel Hill West Stories, an historic and active cemetery in Bala Cynwyd, Pennsylvania. I am Dr. Joe Lex, retired professor of emergency medicine from Temple University, volunteer tour guide, and volunteer podcaster. Laurel Hill West opened in 1869 across the river from its sister cemetery, Laurel Hill East in Philadelphia. It's more than twice as big as Laurel Hill East. It has a totally different feel and a strikingly different population. Like Laurel Hill East, it is open 365 days a year, now from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. There is plenty of parking at the business office just off Belmont Avenue or at the conservatory and the bell tower. Another possibility, come in while you're walking the Cynwyd Trail. 31st episode of Biographical Bites from Bala is for mid-April of 2024. Gladys Hall is little remembered today, but in her heyday of the 1920s and 30s, she interviewed hundreds of movie stars for fan magazines, averaging about 6 articles per month. Her interview with Bela Lugosi has become legendary. Her husband, Russell Ball, who was born in Philadelphia, was one of the top glamour photographers on either coast, who worked with everyone from Louise Brooks to Greta Garbo. Gladys and Russell are buried in an unmarked grave in the Lansdowne section in the long shadow of the Betts Mausoleum, looming overhead in the summit section. The liberal arts of ancient times, architecture, dance, drama, literature, music, painting, and sculpture, had their origins in the Mediterranean basin thousands of years ago. The new arts of photography and cinematography have been around for less than 2 centuries, and they had their origins on the east coast of the United States. If you listen to prior podcast episodes, you know that the first photograph in the United States was produced in Philadelphia in 1839, a daguerreotype of Central High School taken from the U.S. Mint. The first known selfie in the world took place on Chestnut Street, also in 1839, when a lamp maker and chemist Robert Cornelius stood in front of his self-made camera for several minutes and got a decent shot. Cornelius is interred at Laurel Hill East with a copy of his selfie pasted to his tombstone. Now, although we associate moving pictures with Thomas Edison of New Jersey, the first man to make pictures move was another Philadelphian, Coleman Sellers. He made his reputation as an engineer, and in 1860 he took still-posed photos of one of his sons posing in the process of hammering a nail. He mounted these still photos on a revolving paddle wheel, which was then hand-cranked and observed through a peephole. And it appeared to show the action of hammering a nail, although it was a little jerky. Coleman Sellers is interred at Laurel Hill West in the Lansdowne section. The concept behind motion pictures had been described in 1824 in a paper presented by the thesaurus guy, Peter Mark Roget. He explained that since pictures never move, you can give the appearance of motion if you flash images before your eyes in rapid sequence. Although he did not know it at the time, 16 frames per second was the speed needed to make a silent film look authentic. It would trick the optic nerve into seeing continuous motion. Roger called this the persistence of vision. This speed was increased to 24 frames per second when sound came around in the late 1920s. Many of the first commercial movies came from Philadelphia. The Lubin Manufacturing Company was formed in 1902, and it was incorporated in 1909 by German immigrant Sigmund Lubin. He had been in the film equipment and distribution and production business since 1896, when he had become intrigued with Thomas Edison's motion picture camera, and he saw the potential in selling similar equipment as well as in making films. Known as Pop Lubin, he constructed his own combined camera projector, which he called a cineograph. His lower price and marketing know-how brought reasonable success. In 1905, he rented low-cost space on the roof of a building on 8th Street between Ludlow and Ranstead, just a little south of Market. There's a blue historical marker there right now. The insatiable appetite of the American public for motion picture entertainment saw Lubin's film company undergo enormous growth. In 1910, Lubin built a state-of-the-art studio on the corner of Indiana Avenue and 20th Street. The area actually became known as Lubinville. It was one of the most modern studios in the world, complete with a huge artificially lit stage, editing rooms, laboratories, and workshops. The facility allowed several film productions to be undertaken simultaneously. And in 1912, Lubin purchased a 350-acre estate in Bettswood, in what was then rural countryside in the northwest outskirts of Philadelphia, and he converted the property into a studio and film lot. The property had belonged to German brewer John Betts, who has the largest mausoleum in Laurel Hill West in the summit section, just a few hundred feet from the conservatory. And you can see remnants of the studio when you approach Conshohocken while walking the Schuylkill Trail next to the river. Lubin worked with some of the pioneering actors of the silent screen, including Romaine Fielding, Florence Hackett, Alan Hale, Lottie Briscoe, Florence Lawrence, Ethel Clayton, Gladys Brockwell, and Pearl White. Lubin also marked the first film appearance in 1914 of Oliver Hardy. It was also in 1914 that a disastrous fire at its main studio damaged nearby buildings and destroyed the negatives for many unreleased new films, which severely hurt the business. When the Great War broke out in Europe in September of that year, Lubin Studios and other American filmmakers lost a large source of income from foreign sales. Remember, these were silent films. You did not have to understand English, spoken English, to see a silent film. For years, the Lubin Manufacturing Company, like most of the other major film studios, had a running legal battle with Thomas Edison that saw repeated lawsuits brought against Lubin for patent infringement. Eventually, Lubin gave up the costly fight with Edison and became part of the Motion Picture Patents Company, a monopoly on production and distribution which Edison had set up. After Lubin had made more than 1,000 motion pictures, the corporation was forced into bankruptcy. In September 1916, the Lubin Manufacturing Company closed its doors for good. Lubin died in 1923. He's interred in New Jersey. The American film audience was hungry for more material. What had started as, for example, a simple brief film of a strong man lifting weights or a woman walking a dog, they started to get manipulated by geniuses like Edwin Stanton Porter into telling a story by splicing in different actions, close-ups of facial features, costume changes, narration cards to make up for the lack of sound. Porter moved the action away from the theatrical stage to a natural environment. And now that movies could tell stories, they needed accomplished actors in the lead roles. The first movies released didn't even bother to give you the name of who you were looking at on the screen. But movie fans noticed and developed a liking for their favorites. Like, there was this girl with a dimpled chin and curly hair who always played an angelic, innocent sort. Or there's that man with the handlebar mustache and the limp who always seems to play the bad guys. Fans wrote to the studios demanding more information about these screen-dwelling beings to whom they were becoming attached. And it did not take very long for another clever businessman to see an opportunity for profit. And he published a monthly magazine about these mysterious people who seemed to live on the silver screen. And thus was born the Fan Magazine. Movie fan magazines were ephemeral objects. They served two purposes. Number one, keep the fans entertained and informed. And number two, spread gossip and publicity from the various studios, which sprang up in Los Angeles neighborhood that they called Hollywood. East Coast movie makers found the climate out west far more favorable than Pennsylvania and New Jersey, and it started to shift the business to the West Coast. Besides, it was more difficult for New Jersey-based Thomas Edison to sue for copyright infringements on all those people 3,000 miles away who used his equipment. This new industry of publicizing movies and their stars took off at once. The first successful fan magazine was Photoplay, founded in 1911. It started as a short fiction magazine that published summaries of the plots of the new films. The storyline of a short fictional film would be adapted to the printed word, running as long as 5 or 6 pages. It usually took longer to read the story than it did to watch the movie. These movies were just a few minutes long. But publishers soon found that what the reader wanted was more information about the people they were seeing on the screen. Most of the readers were women and girls, and magazine publishers obliged. They hired writers whose names would soon become known to nearly every American filmgoer: Sheila Graham, Hedda Hopper, Dorothy Kilgallen, Luella Parsons, Adela Rogers St. John, Walter Winchell, and many others. Each of these writers had their own legion of followers, and by 1918, the circulation of Photoplay had topped 200,000 issues per month. Other magazines like Modern Screen, Motion Picture, Cine Fantastique soon followed. And there were more than 20 fan magazines that stared at you from the newsstand, ranging from a nickel for the pulp Hollywood up to a quarter for the glamorous Photoplay. Movie fan magazines were intended for an American audience, but they found their way around the world. For instance, while she was hiding in Amsterdam during Nazi occupation of her city, Anne Frank pasted photographs of Diana Durbin and others, which she had clipped from fan magazines, on her bedroom wall. The fan magazines worked in tandem with the studios to smother scandal and to allow favorites to achieve fame, maintain fame, and profit from fame. And prohibition was ignored. Virtually everyone in the movies found a way to drink. Now, these fan magazines led the way to Confidential magazine in the 1950s, National Enquirer in the 1960s, and eventually to People magazine, Us, Entertainment Weekly, and internet sites like TMZ and Hollywood Life. The magazines consumed voracious amounts of material. Many writers, most of them women, stepped forward. And one of the best and most prolific was Gladys Hall. She averaged 6 articles per month for years. You could hardly pick up a movie magazine in the 1920s and not find an article or 2 or even 3 by Gladys. And then you have to look for the things she wrote under one of her several pseudonyms. Janet Reed, that was her mother's maiden name. Faith Service. Russell E. Smith, that's for her husband, Russell E. Ball. And she also used her married name, Gladys Ball. Gladys Hall was born in New York City in 1891. The young Gladys graduated from St. Gabriel's School for Girls in Peekskill, New York. By her own account, Hall began writing popular poetry and short stories at an early age and was published in magazines like Munsey's, Cavalier, and H.L. Mencken's The Smart Set. Hall married photographer Russell E. Ball on 1 February 1912. They were both 20 years old. That same month, a poem by Hall entitled Fetterless was published in the Motion Picture Story magazine, the first movie fan publication, which had been launched the previous year. By December 1913, Hall was a regular contributor to the magazine and was listed in the index as one of several associate editors. The Motion Picture Story magazine was modeled on popular fiction publications of the time. In its early years, each issue featured a dozen or more photoplay stories written in novelized form. As an aspiring author, Hall appears to have found a great deal of success in this genre, which took the often relatively simple plot lines of films and spun them into short fiction. A publicity page located in a scrapbook in the Gladys Hall's papers state that she wrote between 200 and 300 of these photoplay stories in the first decade of her career. Hall also contributed feature stories, profiles, humor pieces to the Motion Picture Story magazine, which was renamed Motion Picture Magazine in 1914. She also edited the magazine's Public Opinion of Popular Plays and Players column. According to an article entitled Good Things a Comin' for 1918, Hall and her fellow associate editors were also assigned to write many of Motion Picture Magazine's monthly features, including Green Room Jottings, the movie gossip shop, limericks, puzzles, photoplay reviews, verses, various other departments. These were published with no accredited authors. And how many of these Gladys Hall wrote, we have no idea. Plus, she continued to write fiction and poetry, as well as serialized novels and plays. And she regularly submitted her work to the many popular magazines of the day, not just movie fan magazines. Gladys Hall became known as one of the best interviewers in the business. In notes for an unpublished memoir entitled Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, Hall recalled that her first movie star interview was with the actor James Cruise in October 1913. As early as January 1914, she published under the name Gladys Ball an interview with Blanche Sweet in the Motion Picture Story magazine. In the late 19-teens and 20s, Hall chronicled the lives and loves of hundreds of stars and, on occasion, writers and directors of the silent screen, often interviewing the always fashionable actresses and reliably dashing actors at their homes or in lavish hotel suites or restaurants, which Hall captured in detail for her readers. In the 1920s, Hall cemented her reputation as an interviewer when she collaborated with fellow Motion Picture Magazine writer and editor Adele Whiteley Fletcher on a string of featured stories on major stars, including Mary Pickford, Wallace Reid, Rudolph Valentino, Charles Chaplin, Gloria Swanson, and Colleen Moore. For this popular series, the interviews were structured as playlets, complete with a cast list, scene numbers, and stage directions. This format made Hall and Fletcher characters in a narrative that was as much about conducting the interview as it was about the interview itself. This also gave the writers the opportunity to comically contrast their own all-too-human shortcomings and prosaic concerns, how to get to the meeting on time, what to order for lunch, with the brilliance and kindness of their interview subjects, reinforcing the notion that stars are in many ways superior to regular folks. Her self-deprecating style is also on display in Here Are the Movie Mommers and Lamentations of a Lady Interviewer. These were both published in Photoplay in December 1921 and March 1922, respectively. In these short humor pieces, each is less than a page long, Hall wrote of the frustrations of dealing with overbearing stage mothers and described being driven insane by uncooperative stars and their ever-present Pekingese dogs. Not all of Gladys's work was self-deprecating or comical. In 1922, Hall wrote a startlingly progressive five-part series on film feminists for Filmplay, a new fan magazine that billed itself as a magazine of importance for every American home. Hall's profiles explored the feminist beliefs of actresses Elsie Ferguson, Madge Kennedy, Olga Petrova, and Lillian Gish, and screenwriter Rita Wyman. Even though the changing role of women in modern society was a frequently debated topic in fan and women's magazines at the time, Hall's articles were noteworthy by putting feminism forward as the theme of the series and for discussing issues like financial independence, socialism, equality in marriage, opportunities for women in the film industry. Hall, who was a working mother and a member of the progressive The Woman Pays Club in New York, often comes across in the articles as more feminist than her interview subjects. For example, when Lillian Gish suggested that women already ruled the world by supporting and encouraging powerful men, Hall disagreed, writing, "I brought forth the objection that it is a humiliating thing to invariably rule from behind something or other, be it a man, war, throne, or philosopher." Several of these articles and other pieces that Hall had written for the fan magazines were reworked for her syndicated newspaper column, The Diary of a Professional Movie Fan, which debuted in April 1922, continued for about a year. In 1927, Hall and her husband, Russell Earl Ball, a noted portrait photographer, relocated their family to Los Angeles, and they settled into a house in Benedict Canyon. Although Hall had always been comfortable writing about film personalities from the vantage point of New York, the move not only gave her easier access to the stars, but it allowed her to write firsthand about the film industry and the studios. And in the 1930s, Hall continued to freelance for a wide variety of fan and women's magazines and was active in the Hollywood Women's Press Club, which she had co-founded in 1928 with Luella Parsons and a small group of fellow writers. And in case you wondered, there was no Hollywood Men's Press Club. By the end of the decade, an article about fan magazine writers, or hacks, as the author called them, acknowledged Hall as the grand old dame of the fannies and reported that she was the most well-paid of all the writers, earning an estimated $10,000 per year. Now, after her husband Russell died in 1942, Gladys Hall Ball moved back to New York, but she continued to contribute regularly to the fan magazines. Now she was singing praises for a new generation of stars. Gladys Hall was a disciplined writer. She got up at 8 o'clock every morning. She was sitting at her typewriter by 9:30. She never learned to type properly. She used a hunt and peck system. She never even learned how to change her own typewriter ribbon. She lunched with a star at least three times a week. And according to one Hollywood commentator, Hall specialized in luncheon appointments. She was acknowledged as the best interviewer eater in the business. And the stars trusted her, and they liked her. When Mary Pickford decided she was going to divorce Douglas Fairbanks, she gave the exclusive story to Gladys Hall. Another of her biggest scoops was an interview with Hungarian-born actor Bela Lugosi for the January 1931 issue of Motion Picture Classic. This was the month before Lugosi struck gold as Count Dracula on the screen, a role that he had introduced on stage 4 years earlier. But in this much-quoted essay, she notes Lugosi as saying,
"But it is women who love horror, gloat over it, feed on it, are nourished by it, shudder and cling and cry out and come back for more. Women who have a predestination to suffering. It is women who bear the race in bloody agony. Suffering is a kind of horror. Blood is a kind of horror. Therefore, women are born with a predestination to horror in their very blood. It is a biological thing."
Gladys says of Lugosi that, quote, "The saga of the vampire, the lore of demonology, the dark secrets of the state of trance, a part of his daily life. The man who never sleeps at night. The man who lies alone in his darkened house. The man to whom no woman can stay married. Why not? No answer. No answer. No answer." There are questions better not put to Bela Lugosi. There are answers better not heard. There are secrets better, much better left interred. Does he eat food, make love, work, play, hope, struggle as other men? No answer. No answer. No answer. Lugosi sat in a deep chair in my library. One does not go to his house. A single light burned above him, making his pallid face more pallid, obliterating all but the red lights burning ceaselessly in his two pale blue eyes. The windows were opened, and there came the mournful sound of the wind in the tall boughs of the eucalyptus. Was it only the wind playing in the boughs of the trees, or was it... No answer. No answer. Better not ask. His voice came, remote and far away, dying down, rising to a penetrating. He said,
"When I was playing Dracula on the stage, my audiences were women. Women. There were men, too, escorts the women had brought with them, for reasons only their dark subconscious knew, in order to establish a subtle sex intimacy, contact, in order to cling and to feel the sensual intimacy of protection. Men did not come of their own volition. Women did. Came and knew an ecstasy dragged from the depths of unspeakable things. Came and then came back again and again."
Was there gloating in his voice? Or was it my chilled imagination playing me tricks, feverish and fantastical?
"Women wrote me letters. Ah, what letters women wrote me. Young girls, women from 17 to 30. Letters of a horrible hunger. Asking me if I cared only for maiden's blood. Asking me if I had done the play because I was in reality that sort of thing. And through these letters, crouched in terms of shuddering, transparent fear, there ran the hideous note of hope. They hoped that I was Dracula. They hoped that my love was the love of Dracula. They gloated over the thing they dared not understand. It gave them something as potent as poison, as separate from their lives as death is separate from life. It was the embrace of death their subconscious was yearning for, death, the final, triumphant lover. It made me know that the women of America are unsatisfied, famished, craving sensation, even though it be the sensation of death draining the red blood of life. Women gloat over death, avidly, morbidly. They will spend hours discussing the details of death, over and over. Wives will spend hours of frightful joy telling of their husbands or their lovers' last words. They will describe with macabre minutiae the death agonies, the death rattle, the awful ceremony of the mortician, the rites of the ceremony. Have you ever watched women talking about death? Don't. It is women who crowd cemeteries using anniversaries, the veil of sentiment, the legitimacy of grief. It is women who crouch over graves, loving them, covering them with flowers and tears. Women feed the cemeteries. Without women, the shattered vases that wear our bodies would be reduced to decent ash, and the ghoulish appetites of the world would be a part of folklore. Women will go to circuses and cast restless, unseeing eyes on clowns and trapeze artists, animals and gymnasts. They will go into the place of the strange people, the freaks, and stand there, mouths agape, transfixed. Back of this, there is, again, a profound biological reason. Before a woman bears a child, she goes through successive phases of horror, lest the fruit of her body be a monstrous thing. When they are looking on these ghastly distortions, they are thinking, again, subconsciously, that such horrors might have happened to them. During the war, women fought, maneuvered, bribed, and schemed to get to the front-line trenches. In their hearts, in their conscious minds, they believed that they were striving for that place in order to perform deeds of duty and mercy to their fellow men, in order to bind their wounds and ease their last grim moments. And so they were. But mixed in with this high motive was the ghoulish compulsion to see men torn and bloody and in agony, the horrible fascination of horror, the need to look upon the suffering, which is a part of their destiny. In the South, where there are lynchings of Negroes, women press to the front of the mob, fight and struggle when they are held back, beat their way to a position where they may see, not miss a detail, be able to retail it all again to their neighbors, less fortunate. At executions in the death house, when men and women are present together, it is the men who faint. Men evade horror. When they cannot evade it, they laugh it off, shrug amused shoulders, pretend to be unimpressed, incredulous. When there is death, men try to get roaring drunk, close it out of their lives and minds. They feel that to succumb to horror is to belie their masculinity, their proud virility. And no man I have ever known who was in the frontline trenches and saw the bloodiest horrors of warfare would go back again unless physically compelled. Women love to go to amusement parks and ride on the most sensational thrillers. Shoot the Chutes, Dip o' Death. When you stand in any amusement park, you can always hear the shrill, wild shrieks of women, loving the horror, the violent sensation, and with the random chance of destruction. I have known women who, deprived of horror, created it for themselves. One woman who walked along city streets and shuddered and grew faint with fear, lest the skyscrapers fall on her. She knew she was shuddering away from the almost impossible. But the thrill she derived from that morbid fancy was necessary to her. She made horror for herself where none existed. The great success of the pictures of Lon Chaney is further proof of the love of horror. Milk and Water, Love, April Romance, Gallant Adventure, all fade by comparison with these grotesque human things struggling with fates as twisted and abnormal as their bodies. It is women who attend the dark parlors of spiritualists, women who attend seances. Whether they believe them or not is of little consequence. The element of horror is there. It is women who discuss the front-page murders with a frantic particularity, devouring every morsel, hungry for more and more. It is women who love horror, shudder and cling and cry, and always willing to come back for more.
In 1950, Flare magazine declared Gladys Hall the undisputed queen of the cozy confession. She was a sympathetic interviewer who avoided writing about scandal and controversy, and she often befriended the stars that she profiled. Late in life, Hall was quoted as saying, People don't want their movie stars torn down. Even if there was something to say against them, it's not what the public wants. The public wants to believe in Santa Claus and in movie stars. Although she had a lengthy career and created an extensive body of work, there's been surprisingly little written about Gladys Hall or her contributions to the popular discourse about film. Unlike fellow fan magazine writer Adela Rogers St. John's, who achieved her own level of celebrity and crossed over to writing film stories, novels, and scenarios, Gladys Hall never became famous outside the pages of the popular magazines that published her work. Okay, let's go back to 1912. Gladys married Russell Ball and became Gladys Hall Ball, but she continued to write mostly under her given name. Russell Ball was also in the publicity business. Motion picture still photography, just like any brand marketing, is all about creating a recognizable and attractive product, appealing to customers and leading to sales. Going a step further, still photography's aim is to fashion a fantastic dream world, taking people into the realm of fervid imagination. Russell Ball was one of the early masters of portraiture. He composed alluring, glamorous images of stage and screen stars, accentuating a naturalistic romanticism in his work. Born 24 March 1891 in Philadelphia, Russell Earp Ball fell in love with photography when he was about 12 years old. He started shooting when he could. He worked as a gaslight manufacturing company salesman in 1910. He supported his mother after his father died. By 1912, Ball was working in New York as a newspaper photographer. That's when he married Gladys Hall. His draft registration in 1917 lists him as a commercial photographer, and per the 1920 census, he was shooting motion picture portraits. In the early 1920s, the Schubert Organization hired him for publicity stills for Sigmund Rumberg Scholl's Innocent Eyes, Marjorie, and The Passing Show of 1923. He was a Broadway photographer by 1923 per David Shields in Still, American Silent Motion Picture Photography. His cerebral, mercurial personality attracted many stage and screen artists. Ball worked as an independent celebrity photographer because he abhorred strict contract control and preferred working autonomously. He provided portraits for various print outlets of such silent stars as Alice Joyce, Alma Rubens, Lillian and Dorothy Gish, Richard Barthelmess. He occasionally traveled west for special shoots for magazines like Photoplay. Motion Picture Magazine featured many glamorous portraits by Ball. Dreamy, gorgeous. Ball's attractive style caught the eye of Rudolph Valentino, who hired him to shoot portraits of him and his wife Natasha Rambova. Ball also shot atmospheric stills for Valentino's film Monsieur Beaucaire, oozing in style through his elegant composition and theatrical lighting. And he went on to produce images of Gloria Swanson for famous players Lasky, Zaza. Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer was impressed with Ball's work and hired him as an independent East Coast stringer in 1925. As such, Ball shot some of the first stills in the United States of a newly arrived Swedish actress named Greta Garbo. When Ball arrived at her hotel suite to photograph Garbo, there was no interpreter available, so they tried resorting to sign language. Garbo's suite was so small that after much experimenting, Ball was forced to pose her against the wall of her bedroom, set his camera to point through the door of her tiny sitting room, and shoot over the bed. Well, despite her annoyance, she chuckled. Ball resorted to all the tricks of the trade to camouflage the background and to avoid showing the bed, and he succeeded. But then he remembered that Dream World magazine would use a cover photo provided Garbo were shown wearing some colorful flowing scarf or neckerchief. Now, Russell later explained what happened. He says, I tried to explain what I wanted, but my English made no impression. Then I drew my hands lightly across my throat to illustrate my point. Greta shuddered, and I realized that I must have looked as though I were committing suicide. I tried again. This time I pretended to throw a scarf over my shoulders and around my neck, and with that her face lighted up peculiarly, and she motioned us to leave the room. Well, in a few minutes she called him back into the suite. He let out an audible gasp. Garbo's interpretation of the signs was not what he expected. About her neck and falling across her body was a flimsy diaphanous scarf. And that was all she wore. Ball took the photo. It quickly became one of the most widely used portrait studies of the new star. By the late 1920s, Russell, Gladys, and their children moved permanently to Los Angeles. They settled in Beverly Hills' Benedict Canyon. He continued to shoot portraits independently for magazines like Cinematographer's Annual and Motion Picture Classic, as well as sessions with stars like Warner Baxter, Lila Lee, Gloria Swanson. She hired him as stills and portraits photographer for her film, What a Widow. Like his wife, Russell occasionally wrote articles for fan magazines, like New Movie Magazine, in which he described the perfect way to make portraits. Ball called photographs, quote, jewels of memory, consolidation in separation, reminders of love and friendship. As such, they should present individuals as themselves, not replicas of some famous personality or star. As he declared, look like you. Do not try to look like somebody else. Ball described the goal of photography as coaxing out the real inner person. Ball emphasized naturalism and harmonious surroundings, shot with little to no decoration, such as bare backgrounds, perhaps a little prop, like a block of wood or dramatic lighting to keep the focus on the subject. And by natural, he meant just that. Little or no makeup, no elaborate hairstyling, no special dress or jewelry. Just something that renders the person comfortable and relaxed. And expression is the most important. Think of pleasing, happy moments to bring joy and be less self-conscious. The photographer suggested several techniques to add beauty and realism. Ball stated a slightly open mouth adds charm to a portrait. Those being photographed should exhibit arrested motion, not be set and stiff, with the photographer capturing them in spontaneous moments. A man should frown slightly in a business portrait, which added virility and strength to his look. Those with light-colored eyes should never look directly into the lens, but slightly away. As Ball also stated in a Picture Play article about celebrity portrait taking, once a picture has appeared in print, it is immediately useless. It is no longer exclusive. He described how stars unhappy with studio portraits came to him in his messy, unpretentious studio every 3 months or so for new images to send out for publicity purposes. Ball would shoot around 75 to 200 images to select from, then print anywhere from 500 to 1,000 prints for the stars to distribute. Ball kept one-word descriptions on some of his clients. Lillian Teschman was crystal. Laura LaPlante, dove-like. Esther Taylor, exotic. Evelyn Brent, mysterious. Ball was at MGM for a short time, and he left to open his own gallery at 9528 Brighton Way in Beverly Hills, where he shot images of both celebrities and wealthy patrons. Starting in 1942, Russell and Gladys co-wrote some plays as she continued her work as one of the most important film journalists of the time. On 12 June 1942, Russell Ball died unexpectedly of a heart attack at age 51. He left behind his wife and children. His body was brought back east, and he was buried in the Ball family plot at Laurel Hill West. His 100-year-old photos are just as eye-catching and glamorous as the day that he shot them. Go to Russell Ball's page on Wikipedia and look at some samples of his photography. You'll see what I mean. After Russell died, Gladys moved back to New York City to be near one of her daughters. She died in September 1977. She's interred with Russell in an unmarked grave at Laurel Hill West. Photoplay magazine outlasted her by only about 3 years. It ceased publication in 1980. During the 1920s and the 1930s, when as many as 80 million Americans went to the movie theater on a regular basis, the fans got much of the news about the stars they loved from reading the columns and the interviews and the articles of Gladys Hall and by sighing over the glamorous photographs of her husband, Russell Ball. Today, they are virtually unknown in an unmarked grave. The May 2024 episode of All Bones Considered, Laurel Hill Stories number 61, is about some more magazine publishers in Philadelphia. Now, everyone knows about Cyrus Curtis and the Saturday Evening Post and Sarah Josepha Hale and Godey's Ladies Book, but dozens of magazines have been printed here. Graham's Magazine, Peterson Magazine, Lippincott's Magazine were among the favorites of the late 19th century. And then there's Philadelphia Magazine, which has been around since 1908. In Biographical Bites from Bala, Laurel Hill West Stories, episode number 32, from mid-May, I will talk about guitarist and teacher Dennis Sandole, who was a hidden Philadelphia treasure for years, and the man who introduced music theory beyond chords and scales to John Coltrane, James Moody, Benny Golson, Art Farmer, Jim Hall, Pat Martino, and many others. I will play some music in this one, maybe a lot of music. For activities at the cemetery, go to the website, www.laurelhillphl.com/events. Lots of stuff coming up. All Bones Considered and Biographical Bites from Bala are mostly researched, written, narrated, and produced by me, Joe Lex, retired professor of emergency medicine from Temple University, volunteer tour guide and podcaster for both cemeteries. You can reach me through my email, jrlexjr1947@gmail.com. I've changed it. My old email address died, I'm afraid. So once again, if you're just hearing that for the first time, it's jrlexjr1947@gmail.com. The theme song, Names at Peace, was written and performed by local artist James Harrow. And a special thanks to Tom Franklin for giving us that nice Bela Lugosi Hungarian accent as Bela told his story. Maybe I will see you on a tour. I'm doing a couple in May. I'm doing an accessible hotspots tour on 11th at Laurel Hill East, and I'm doing a tour at West that is anything but accessible. It is a cross-country jaunt of sporting heroes buried at Laurel Hill West. That's coming up on May 18th. That should be a lot of fun. Join me on that one. Okay, maybe I'll see you on a tour. Stay safe, stay well. The bibliography follows, and it's a pretty long one. Bibliography for this. Gladys Hall deserves a biography sometime. Russell Ball probably deserves one also. They both led such fascinating lives. The best information that I got, a lot of stuff on Gladys, was written by a woman named Barbara Hall, and she does not indicate whether she is a relative of Gladys, but it's an online Women Film Pioneers project. There's really no title for this, but it gave me just gobs of good information. It's got a really nice bibliography with it that led me on to different things. Oh, here we go. Citation, Barbara Hall, Gladys Hall, in Jean Gaines, Radha Vatsal, and Monica Dal Asta's editors. Women Film Pioneers Project, New York, New York, Columbia University Libraries, 2016. And then there was another online article called The Feminine Love of Horror by Gladys Hall. This is the one where that amazing Bela Lugosi interview came from. And I didn't give credit to Tom Franklin for doing that terrific Hungarian accent. Sorry about delaying that. I took a lot of information about the early history of movies from an article in American Heritage called The Moving Image, written by Robert Gessner, G-E-S-S-N-E-R, April 1960, Volume 11, Issue 3. Another online source says the following post by Anne Helen Peterson is part of our online companion to our Winter 2013 issue on Classic Hollywood. And let me see if there's any more identifying information on this one. No, but here's another online article by Anne Helen Peterson called The Rules of the Game, A Century of Hollywood Publicity. The Wikipedia articles on photoplay and on fan magazines in general are not terribly helpful. There's an article called American Fan Magazines in the 1930s and the Glamorous Construction of Femininity by Anne Jerslev, J-E-R-S-L-E-V. And I'm looking from where that is from. And this PDF has absolutely no other information on it. I downloaded it. Okay, so I guess you're going to have to depend on the title if you want to find that one. But I got that online. That was free. These were not free. These came from my JSTOR account, but some really good stuff. There's an article called You Are Invited to Participate, Interactive Fandom in the Age of the Movie Magazine by Marcia Orgeron, O-R-G-E-R-O-N. That's from the Journal of Film and Video, Fall 2009, Volume 61, Number 3, pages 3 to 23. Then there's Reviewing the Fan Mags by Tamar Jeffers McDonald. That is from Film History, Volume 28, Number 4, pages 29 to 57. Artifice and Atmosphere, The Visual Culture of Hollywood Glamour Photography, 1930-1935. Author Patrick Keating, Film History, Volume 29, Number 3, pages 105 to 135. Revealing Reality, Fan Magazine Rhetoric, Sound Technology and Stardom in the Early Sound Era. Michael Slowick, Journal of Film and Video, Volume 70, Number 2, Summer 2018, pages 30 to 45. Like I said, that was a lot, because none of this has ever been consolidated anyplace. And that's why somebody eager to do this, maybe a joint biography, maybe a movie about Gladys and Russell. They seem to have extremely exciting, active lives. Okay, thanks a lot for listening. See you around the cemetery.